Today's date is March 24, 2011, and the session title is Grand Challenges. The session coaches are my Ram Sriram, Ernie Lucer, and Alden Dima. Then we have several panelists here. First, what I'm going to do is to kind of show the slide of the goals of the session, and then I'll briefly talk about, mention the panel panelist names and the order which they would be presenting. Can I have the first slide, Peter? As the goals of this Grand Challenges track is for a specific domain, we would like the panelists to summarize the current state of the art on ontology use in that particular domain, determine the gaps that hinder real-world ontology applications, and enumerate the actions that need to be taken to overcome these gaps. Essentially, the idea is that for a particular domain, we want to see, we want to have a Grand Challenge domain eventually. So for the domains you are talking about, give us a brief description of your domain and what the grand challenges are for ontology applications as such. So that's the summary. So we have a number of speakers here. Next slide, please. So that's order of the speakers, and we had to do this order for various reasons in terms of some of the speakers have to leave early. And I think you know most of the speakers, so I don't want to give any bio of them. First speaker is Chris Welty from IBM Research, and he'll be talking about the grand challenge for Watson-like systems. And we have Professor Ramesh Jain. He'll be talking about the ontology-based event recognition. Professor Elliot Siegel, he'll come back and talk about the Watson project. Professor Chris Choate talk about the relationships among biomedical ontologies and classifications, in particular with reference to ICD-11. Professor Neville Adams is going to talk about ontology applications in homeland security, and we'll finally end with Eileen Bartomello, who will not be here, but the presentation will be made by Chris Frangioni, and he's going to talk about the XPRIZE in particular. Title is Revolution Through Competition, Designing Effective Incentive Prizes. So our first speaker is Chris Welty. Chris, why don't you go ahead?
Very great. So I'll just talk for a minute, and then I guess my idea was that I would take questions mainly. We did the Watson Challenge this past February. The original idea of it was to try to get an open domain natural language question answering system up to expert human performance levels in 4 years. Even regardless of the outcome, which really the game could have gone either way, I think we successfully demonstrated that we were at expert levels of human performance in answering open domain questions. And the system that everyone saw running there had many different components, probably over 200 different, maybe even more than that, components, and really there was no one part of the system, no technique, no technology that really dominated. It was our ability to put a lot of different approaches to similar problems together that got us to that level of performance. So we did use a little bit of ontology. We didn't use one ontology. We used probably about 15 different ones. We got them from DBpedia, we used Wikipedia categories, we used lots of resources like that, and we didn't try to map them or align them. We just used them as evidence to help understand the degree to which possible answers generated using very shallow methods corresponded to the type of things that the questions we're asking for. For the next steps in Watson, we're looking at medical applications. It's not really clear exactly what we'll do in the medical space, but the idea of combining evidence from a variety of different sources, which is at the heart of the way Watson works, is an idea that a lot of people in medical informatics find very alluring. And I think it should make a difference for a lot of different problems if we can get the right kinds of information, evidence, together for whatever task. I mean, one possible task is diagnosis. Another possible task is treatments. Another possible task is drug interactions. We haven't really decided where to go next. Okay, so I think I'll just let people ask questions. What's the procedure for doing that?
We have Nabil's hand up there. Nabil Adam?
Yes, okay. In regard to medical oncology, I am sure, I assume you are aware of UMLS, for example, and SNOMED. As you know, UMLS was sponsored by NIH for a number of years. Are you making use of those ontologies?
As I said, not in the Jeopardy system. I would imagine a medical application that was related to the areas that UMLS covers would be, would find benefit from having it.
You mentioned the drug ontologies, the drug interactions. That actually is an area that's covered by UMLS and also SNOMED. Just a suggestion that maybe you want to look at those. Probably you did already. And I think what would be interesting is how do you see specific areas that you want to advance and expand on those two ontologies, among others, actually, in the area of medical.
Yeah, one of our methodologies was not to make anything specifically for this project, but rather to reuse things that were already out there. But I'm certainly not the medical expert on the team, so when we pick a direction to go, the sort of domain experts will be responsible for identifying sources that will be useful for.
Is Chris Chute online here? Maybe Chute is gonna talk a little bit on that when it comes to his presentation.
Okay.
So maybe you wanna wait until that time. Unless Chris wants to comment right now. Chris, if you want to comment right away, then you'll have to do *3 on your phone. Please.
Yes, I'm online now.
Okay, yeah. So if you wanna comment on the previous questions, are you
wanna a lot of the existing medical ontologies, and in particular their interrelationships, somewhat to death, so I don't know that we want to take the time up here.
Okay.
Uh-huh.
Okay, then, so now the next question will be from Alex. Alex Gatz.
Okay. Yeah. I was just wondering, Chris, you mentioned that you were using several resources, not only ontologies, but you were also using several knowledge sources. How were you relating all of these sources that you were using? How were you relating them so that coherent answer could be produced?
Well, we didn't relate them directly. We basically use linguistically founded matching methods to try to, I mean, what we get is a question that has, usually the question has some indication of the type of the answer in the question, like, you know, this 20th century singer was known for, you know, some wearing feathers or something like that. And so we know one kind of evidence that we use for scoring our answers is whether or not it's of the right type. And there's about 15 different algorithms and sources that we use for gathering evidence about typing. And each one of those is compared to this word that was used in the question and, produces a score, which is an indicator of how much that source and the algorithm that's using that source thinks some answer is of the right type, of the type that's being asked for.
So you were using the ontologies just as control vocabularies. You were not using the ontologies in their capacity to support any reasoning task.
That's right.
Okay.
This is Steve Ray. Can I?
Yeah, Steve, go ahead now. Okay. You're the next.
Actually, Chris, you partially just answered the question I was going to ask, which was basically if ontologies as we understand them weren't available to you and that kind of approach was not available, how would you have done this differently, or could you have done it easily or not? And I guess part of your answer is going to be, well, you were just using the taxonomy, so you weren't really exploiting the power of ontologies. But could you comment on that perspective?
I mean, that's right. We were not really using them as ontologies. We were just using them as ways to match the nearly infinite variety of language for sort of applying type-like labels to things. There's a slide in the presentation which you can watch on the IBMWatson.com website that shows the frequency of different type words in historical Jeopardy questions over the past 20 years. And there's a very long tail. There's about, in a sample of 20,000 questions, there's about 10,000 type words that were only used once in the history of the show. Things like form. We had an interesting one in the televised contest. I think it was oddity. That had never appeared as a type before. It was, you know, the answer was that the guy was missing a leg, and the word used in the question was, you know, this oddity. This is the oddity of this Olympic star. So without any real control on how people express things, almost any word could potentially be used as a type. So we just need to get evidence from as many sources as we can to try to help with this, you know, rich variety that language has.
So primarily a type classification was the main purpose of that. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, I would be a little careful in this world about saying classification. All we're doing is trying to associate the degree to which a particular word describes the type of a particular answer.
Okay.
Okay, Fabian?
My question was, if you go to, let's say, the medical field, certainly reliability is much more important than on a game show. Of course, more is at stake in a way. Of course, on the plus side, you have more time because you don't compete for answers. So what is the strategy of... How do you make the system more reliable or better at knowing when it doesn't know? Which you probably need to do when you deal with something like prescriptions of medicine or drugs.
Well, I think certainly it would be hard to argue against the fact that Watson is much better than people at estimating when it's right and wrong and turning that estimate into a statistically meaningful number. You know, when people use, even doctors, even trained doctors, when they use statistical numbers in diagnosis, they're usually not really rigorously vetted. And that's not true of the machine. So I don't think we need to do that much there. I think it's already much, much better than people are.
I'm not sure whether that's true from a legal point of view, because, I mean, IBM or whoever operates the system might face lawsuits if the machine makes a mistake, and that the courts will give the machine the same kind of, you know, treatment as a human is not clear. So I'm not sure that that's really, and people wouldn't expect more reliability from a machine than from a doctor, actually.
Well, I don't care what they expect. If the machine we build isn't in combination with a doctor is not more reliable, across some large set than doctors by themselves, then there's absolutely no point in having a machine at all. So our goal would be to take some process where there's known reliability problems today, and with the augmentation of using a tool like this to make that, to improve the reliability of that process. Of course, it won't be perfect, but we also don't envision the machine being, you know, alone in the hospital diagnosing patients or recommending treatments by itself. It's going to be a tool that a medical practitioner would use.
Yeah, I think, Chris, we have only one last question. We need to move on. So, Michael, quick question.
Hi, Chris. Would you say that actually Watson is really like an anti-challenge? In a sense that somebody could say, look at all the amazing things we did, and we didn't really use ontologies to some great extent at all. We don't really need ontologies to do all this stuff.
So an anti-challenge for ontology.
Yeah.
So
we're
yeah.
The case of ontology, and you're actually making the case against ontology.
I'm not trying to make a case against ontology, but we didn't really use ontology very much as it's practiced. That may be an artifact of the domain, of the sort of the linguistic properties of the way questions are asked in an open domain. It has yet to be seen whether those kinds of resources in the medical domain will be useful for any particular, whichever task we choose to, you know, to go after next.
Okay.
Just one follow-up, Rob, just a follow-up from that. So could you think there'd be some way of organizing, say, experiments where you say, well, here is what a system like Watson does without ontologies, without a rich ontology, and then to say, okay, well, if we augment it with ontology, it's improving the performance. Would there be some way of using some kind of mock-up, simplified version of that for those kinds of experiments?
Yeah, we already do that. We already have done that. So we're set up to do that experiment once we have a new domain. We've done that for the Jeopardy domain, and anything more structured or more formally organized or rigorously axiomatized makes no difference whatsoever for Jeopardy.
Okay, I think we need to kind of go to the next speaker. Before that, Chris, what do you think is a grand challenge problem? A grand challenge problem. Let's do it.
do you want me to give you examples of grand
challenge? Yeah, the example of a grand challenge problem, yeah, that you see.
Oh, I think, I give three examples of things that have, you know, medical experts have told me seem like grand challenges. One is, significantly improving diagnosis, especially in cases where you don't have any clear indication of the diagnosis from existing testing methods. Treatments is a possible grand challenge here, where personalizing the treatment for a already determined diagnosis is a real challenge because it requires having evidence from family history, patient history, et cetera, physiology and so forth. And then drug interaction seems like another grand challenge. Even with drug interaction databases, there's still a lot of data in English that isn't being processed in these interaction databases that could significantly improve, you know, problems that are occurring today.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you, Chris. I think we need to go to the next speaker now. It's going to be Ramesh. Ramesh, are you on?
Hello, this is Ramesh.
Yeah, Ramesh, go ahead.
Oh, okay. So I'm going to talk on a topic that's going to be very different than what you heard from Chris. I'm going to talk about how ontologies can be used for slightly different application, and that is not the description but recognition purposes. And I'm going to talk about this in the context of social life networks. So next slide. Social life networks, they are purely based on several new trends. The first trend is that we have now social networks, and their role is all very clear to all of us. The second trend related to social networks is the trend of microblogs, which commonly people call Twitter. I will use the term microblog to differentiate from a company's approach to how do we deal with what we consider micro events. The next important thing that's happening is something called Internet of Things, which has become extremely popular topic all over the world, that how do we start connecting every device, every sensor on Internet. But the most important thing that is happening in the world right now, according to me, is that more than 75% of the people in the world, even in very poor and developing part of the world, now carry a device that earlier could not be imagined. And these people are almost all the time completely connected. And that starts bringing in some major revolutions. And in that respect, let's go to next slide. When we look at social networks, the basic idea behind social networks has always been that we are trying to put together how do we connect people. So if we click on the slide, then we see that we are now connecting people. And the whole idea has been that people are from many different places and how we will start connecting them. Now, this simple idea has resulted in some remarkable things. For example, if you go to next slide, we start seeing that what happened recently in the world is a truly very interesting phenomena. And that is that some simple event started. So when I click on the slide, I start seeing that something started with a very simple tweet. And these tweets started coming one after the other. Each tweet was nothing but a micro event. And with this micro event, finally we saw that it took place as a major revolution. This process for the first time started about more than a year ago in Iran. But now we have seen its influence all over the world. It has taken place in many, many places. Let's go to the next slide. When we start looking at the whole world, as a technical person, I look at the whole world from slightly different perspective than economists have. C.K. Prahlad made the term bottom of the pyramid very popular all over the world. His argument was that we should not ignore the poorest of the poor people in the world, and we should focus on them in order to make multinationals more successful in meeting needs of these people. His concept and his philosophy resulted in sending the approach adopted by many of these multinational companies. Let's look at this world population from slightly different perspective. Today, top 1.5 billion people in the world have mobile phones, particularly smartphones. They are connected using all kind of internet connectivity. And these people are the people like us who live in developed countries, or these are some top people in the developing world. Then there is this next layer, which I call middle of the pyramid, or middle 3 billion people. These people have phones, they are connected on the internet, they are reasonably well off according to their own country situation. And then there are this bottom 2 billion people who are really poorest of the poor, and technically they are not connected, and it is very difficult for us to help them today. But if we start considering the needs of this middle 3 billion people and start trying to do something so that their situation improves, then the effect will propagate downwards and bottom people will also be helped. So based on this idea, let's look at what can we do in the next slide. We can really start thinking about social life networks. So the question then becomes is, what is a social life network? The next slide shows us, can we go to the next slide, please? Yes. The next slide shows that now we have changed the connectivity slightly. Different people can be connected to not only people, but there are other services also. Using Internet of Things, using sensors, and all these people are now getting connected to the network. Now, because this is already the trend all over the world, can we build on this trend and take this concept of network to the next level where in social network, we are connecting people to people. Now, can we connect people and resources? So if you click on the slide, you see that these devices or this network now can start connecting people and resources. We realize that this is the biggest problem to be solved. And in order to solve this problem in this network, what we can do is a very simple thing. We can make this network, if we click on the slide, we see that we can start putting a lot of powerful things here. And in clicking once more, we start seeing that then there are interesting things like we can take all these micro blocks and micro events that are coming in and start doing aggregation and composition of these micro events into more meaningful events. And based on all those compositions, we can start detecting what kind of situations may be taking place there. And based on these situations that are detected, the system can decide who should get what information, where the alert should be sent, and if people are asking queries, what kind of answer they should be getting. Now, when we try to do this, we realize that two major problems in this are aggregation and composition and the situation detection. How do we solve these problems becomes the big challenge to us. So let's go to the next slide, please. This is emphasizing the applications of these things, but let's go to the next slide. In the next slide, we are showing you some work that we started doing some time ago. Basically, in this work, we were trying to analyze swine flu. And effectively, this diagram on the left side shows that we could collect, based only on tweets, all over the country, how people were reacting or what kind of situation was going on with respect to people's health in context of the swine flu. And this thing, we did some simple image processing techniques, applied it to this aggregation image, and on the right-hand side, we started seeing which area are highly active in terms of swine flu and which areas are not much active in terms of swine flu. Now, once we have done this, let's go to the next slide. We can do something very interesting. The system can start taking actions. And if we click on the slide, we start seeing that suppose somebody complains in a tweet that he is having a sore throat. And as soon as this thing happens, the system knows where is the high swine flu alert, where is the low swine flu alert, based on the place from the tweet is coming, the system can itself decide where do we go or what kind of advice we give to this particular person. That means just a simple tweet by a person sends a query to this social life network type of system, and the system can suggest what action they should take. So going to the next slide, this is the kind of next slide shows, this is the kind of processing that is required for this. In this processing, as we see from the bottom, there is raw data coming from all kind of sources. They could be the tweets, they could be cameras, traffic, weather, or whatever kind of sources that could be reporting automatically in terms of micro events. At the next level, which we call level one, this data has to be compiled into what we call STT, space, time, and theme data. Depending on what we are interested in, we start collecting that. And so each pixel in this case becomes a location based on lat long. And we are accumulating the information that is coming for particular theme from different sources there. And that results in the kind of image that you saw in the previous slide. And this image can be then processed to detect what kind of events are going on. And from there, we can detect what could be the situation. And this becomes the most challenging task. If we go to the next slide, when we start seeing in this, the important thing is, let's just click on this slide, and we see that computationally, the biggest challenge for this is that we are given all kind of data, which can be very easily represented as bits and bytes, and we know in computers how do we convert it to alphanumeric characters, lists and arrays, and how do we represent that images. On the other hand, all the users, all people like you and me, when we see in this diagram, we start seeing that we like to talk in terms of events and objects, and those events and objects are the things that get converted to different kinds of knowledge, leading to insights and all kind of things that we consider wisdom and all this kind of thing. So when we look into this, what is the biggest problem? And we realize that the biggest problem, if we click on this once more, is really this something that people commonly call semantic gap. Let's go to the next slide. The semantic gap is really defined in the following term. Without going into the details of this, the important part is that a linguistic description that we always use is always contextual. Whereas when you look at the images or any kind of data sources, they are look very different from this. So the issue is, how do we build a semantic gap? And people realized in many fields that in order to bridge the semantic gap, let's go to the next slide, the only way to solve the semantic gap problem is to use different kinds of models. And that's why, as the next slide shows, on the models, in sciences, we used different kinds of models, physical, mathematical, and logical types of models. But when we started building the software, we started using models that are very, very different. And the models that we use in software, they allow scientists to use the computational power to study, manipulate, visualize different kinds of entities and relationship among those entities, etc. When we look at this and go to the next level, next slide, we see that ontologies were developed precisely for this purpose, that can we represent models that our software can use, not the people, but the software can start understanding those models and start using those models. Next slide, please. When we go to this, what we realize is that currently, most of these ontological models were developed, and without going into all the details of this thing, they are extremely good for describing events and entities. Their whole purpose is descriptions. They are very rich on the side of entities or what you call endurance, but they are not that well developed on the side of perdurance. Now, next slide. That's what has been happening. Ontologies have been used for description of domain knowledge. Let's go to the next slide. The issue that we started facing, and I'm very interested in, is how can we modify ontologies to deal with recognition? Because in recognition, we already know about something. That means we have a model, and we want to recognize that particular object or that from the data, what this particular thing could be. Next slide, please. Tom Binford, long time ago, put together this diagram. This is very inspirational diagram to consider how we can use ontology. In this diagram, as you see on the left-hand side, you start with the model. In this particular case, because he was talking about computer vision, he put the 3D object model. And from there, depending on from where you are looking at the object, you could create two-dimensional projections, you could create surfaces, and then you could go and go to different kinds of features in those kind of things. On the right-hand side, you see how the data flow can usually take place. You can start at the bottom where you have the image data values, and from there you start applying the image processing to get different features, etc. And you can keep going, and you have to do the mapping at different levels. The current form of ontologies do not allow us to do this. They allow us to look at 3D object model. So we started thinking, how do we go to the next step? So the next slide, please. This slide is showing at a very high level how we are implementing some of these concepts, and we are trying to put together this in ontology framework. Starting from upper ontologies, we can start defining ontologies for particular domain events. For example, I could be designing ontologies for wedding. I can be designing ontologies for different kinds of trips and so on. Let's consider what happens. Let's say I'm supposed to have a trip. The trip ontology, which will be defined in terms of upper ontology, and we will start calling it domain ontology, will be including what happens in a trip. I start on a trip, I go, suppose that this is a sightseeing trip, I will be visiting different places and so on. Now, when you have done this, you are given data about a trip. Suppose that you are using your mobile phone and you are going, and it has GPS track, and it also has you are taking pictures at some place, or you are collecting other kinds of data there. Then the issue becomes, can the system automatically recognize when were you eating, when were you attending conference, when were you going to do sightseeing, and what kind of sights you are seeing, etc. Now, for this particular purpose, what we do is that we take a trip ontology, and suppose that I'm going on a bathing trip. My system knows I'm going to bathing. My calendar knows that I'm going to be staying at this particular hotel, and then it can go to different sites like Yahoo Travels and find out what are the important places people normally visit when they go to those places. And for those places, it can create branches. So what I can do is that from the domain ontology, I can augment my ontology based on the context. And this particular context is put in this bottom level of this thing, that trip to Beijing, and it will start putting things like visiting summer palace or visiting Forbidden City and so on. Let's go to the next slide. What we also do is that because we want to use this augmented ontology for recognition, we start putting some of the features that will be used for recognition purposes. For example, I can put the latitude and longitude of the Forbidden City and the Summer Palace and all this kind of places. I can also put the visual characteristics of those by going to sites like Flickr or other places where all this information is available. And then from my data, when I get all the data, I can start doing the clustering, and the problem then becomes a simple graph mapping problem. That's shown here, that I have from the data, I use the similar kind of features, and I'm grouping those, and then I start doing the clustering of those, and then I map those clusters with the augmented ontology, and that helps me recognizing things. So this is the approach that we are introducing in terms of modifying ontologies for recognition purposes.
Ramesh, Elliot has to, as a hard, I guess he needs to leave in about 10 minutes, Elliot?
In fact, I will have to leave in about 6, 7 minutes. Also.
Okay, Ramesh, can we stop here and let Elliot get on to the thing? I'm sorry, here.
Yeah.
So okay. We can come back to this later on, okay?
Okay.
Elliot? Okay.
Hi, this is Elliot Siegel. Sorry about that. I didn't mean to interrupt at all.
That's okay. I'm glad that you pointed this out. I was just about going to anyway.
Oh, good. Thanks. It's a really interesting talk, so I hated to cut it short at all.
Go ahead, Elliot.
Okay. So I'm going to do a fairly quick presentation, and this is going to elaborate on the conversation that we already had with regard to the IBM Jeopardy and now Dr. Watson project. And what I've been invited to do, which I'm delighted to, and I'm hoping I can answer questions in the future when there's a little bit more time, is to talk about how I see the Dr. Watson Project from a clinical perspective as far as grand challenges. So just to summarize, I have responsibility for radiology in a number of VA hospitals. I also am professor and vice chair of radiology at University of Maryland. I also have responsibility for imaging for the CA Big Project. So I have a strong interest in personalized medicine and ontologies also. But what I'm going to emphasize really is more the clinical perspective on this project and where I see some of the potential grand challenges. So slide number two, please. So first of all, I want to thank you for the opportunity to participate in the session. I can't think of any quote-unquote grander challenges than what I think we have the potential to have associated with the Dr. Watson Project, which could potentially harbinger a renaissance of research and applications in artificial or computational intelligence in medicine. And as those of you who are on the call probably know, attempts in the past for large-scale medical expert systems have met with really very limited limited success. And I at the hospital, for example, myself, really have very few options if I want to be able to utilize more generalized expert systems for making diagnosis. And so these really are not in widespread use in medicine today. In fact, search engines such as Google are really used by most of our practitioners. And so the potential for expert systems in medicine is huge if we can overcome the roadblocks and barriers. Next, please. So some of you may be familiar with some of the previous attempts at artificial intelligence in medicine. One of them was the Mayan system developed at Stanford, which was really part of a doctoral dissertation by Edward Shortleff, which was designed essentially as a sepsis diagnostic system. It has a simple inference engine, a knowledge base of about 600 rules, and it got an accuracy that was judged to be around 69%, which actually was better than most of the ID experts at Stanford. And it was never really actually used in practice due to lack of accessibility, because there really were no ways to generally access a system such as that back then. The next systems were Caduceus, which was developed at University of Pittsburgh based on interviews with Dr. Jack Myers. And next slide, please. And so the Caduceus system had a database of about 1,000 diseases. And at University of Pittsburgh, internist 1 and 2 were also developed. And curiously enough, they were also based on expertise of one physician, Dr. Jack Myers, who was, I believe, head of internal medicine at Pittsburgh. It worked best when it was applied only to a single disease, so it would essentially lead one down to a single diagnosis. It took a long amount of training. The interface was unwieldy, and it could take 30 to 90 minutes just to interact with the system. That system was succeeded by something called Quick Medical Reference, which tended to be more of a reference source rather than a expert diagnostic system. Next, please. And so just as far as my involvement with IBM and the Jeopardy and Watson Project, I had the opportunity to visit the IBM team about a year and a half ago and engage the Jeopardy team for the potential for the next steps after Jeopardy being medical applications. And so we began initial research funded with IBM about a year ago. And we are currently working on this grant that we have from IBM for initial exploratory work with us helping the IBM team to understand the medical domain better. And we've been working together on deeper understanding of the medical domain using a number of different resources. Next, please. And so the IBM team came to visit us at University of Maryland in the VA to see the EMR, and we'll talk about that a little bit. And we've subsequently applied, along with Columbia and Nuance, for the NIH Transformative Research Awards, the TR01 grant, that quote-unquote is designed to pursue major opportunities and gaps in biomedical research that no single NIH institute could tackle alone. It's for quote-unquote exceptionally high-impact trans-NIH programs. Next, please. And so although we're collaborators and we've been working together on the project, I should give you a disclaimer that my vision of where the work could go in the future, and what, as Chris pointed out, IBM actually does could be two different things. So I'd like to talk a little bit about the vision and some of the discussions that we've had internally about possibilities, but I certainly can't give you a timeline or specifics of what IBM itself will necessarily do. Next, please. From a conceptual standpoint, what we want to do is take Watson to medical school. And there are three major components similar to our medical student education that we want. The first is what I'll call book knowledge. The second is to create a simulation of the human physiology. And the third is actual experiential learning from an actual electronic medical system. Next, please. And so we work to book learning. Most of what the Jeopardy team has done so far has really been what I would classify as book learning, including textbooks, journals, internet resources, quiz materials. And like a medical student alone, if all it had was expertise in textbooks and books and journal articles, it would become the same hypochondriac that all medical students tend to become, where they don't really know what the probability of disease is. And so when they hear that a disease is associated with blurry eyes and fatigue and some muscle pain, they all assume that they have that disease, not knowing the relative incidence and prevalence and other things about the diseases that you learn from a more practical perspective. Next, please. So what IBM calls the Deep QA knowledge system has really utilized a number of sources, Harrison's, Merck, the Merck manual, current medical diagnosis and treatment, and many other resources. We started out looking at New England Journal of Medicine clinical pathologic correlation cases. And for those of you who are familiar with that, you know that that represents a discussing professor at Mass General who typically discusses an unknown case that's either an unusual disease process or an unusual manifestation of a common disease process. And so as time has gone on, we've been working on developing interactive capabilities to develop hypotheses and then refine them. And the goal has been to develop a tool that will allow Watson to be able to, in a more automated way, get physician feedback from various hypotheses. And so the idea is that we want to have it to be able to learn and get feedback in an interactive way. Next slide, please. And so the second thing that we're really interested in doing is applying a simulation model of human physiology. And so there's been work that's been done at University of Maryland, where I am, at the School of Medicine and at UMBC, by Dr. Bruce Jarrell and colleagues, looking at creating a physiologic simulation of a human. And so in addition to just the textbook, if one could understand and simulate the physiology of certain disease states, we believe that that is something that a Watson-like suite of software could benefit from significantly. And work has been done to create simulations of disease processes and then observe how it affects other physiology in the body. And this work is not unique. A number of people have looked at these types of medical simulations. Next, please. The third leg in the medical student analogy chair has been clinical hospital experience. And so what we want to have is have the Watson software be able to consume the electronic medical record, which, as many of you know, to a large extent, is really just a digital representation of paper nowadays. It's very primitive. It can't search, for example, for terms such as rash and progress notes in most electronic medical records. And so we have access to records at University of Maryland and the VA and also larger repositories from the greater database that contains many, many electronic records from many VA systems. Next, please. And so with the IBM team, we explored some of the electronic medical record challenges and limitations with the systems that we have, including the fact that there are many different challenges with things such as progress notes being structured and unstructured, and there being many types of unstructured information from the electronic medical record. Next, please. And so when we reviewed the electronic medical record, we found that despite the fact that systems such as the VA's electronic medical record called VISTA has been highly publicized and praised, and it's been very effective as sort of an electronic version of a chart, there are lots of problems. I mentioned the problem with not being able to search for a term within or among medical records. The majority of the data is unstructured. Much of the text in progress notes and other types of notes is highly redundant because interns and residents and attending physicians typically cut and paste information. And so you have notes you have node bloat, essentially, gets larger and larger as people incorporate each other's components of other notes and other information. You don't have hypertext links, for example, in an electronic medical record. And, of course, there are issues with abbreviations that are not consistent and misspellings as well. So next, please. One of the things that we looked at as a challenge, which could certainly be a grand challenge in and of itself, is the patient problem list. And so physicians at random times seem to add problems to a problem list in an electronic medical record, but there's no overall sheriff. There's no overall system to check to see whether problems are actually active or whether the problems actually relate to any of the other information in the electronic medical record. Okay, slide 16, please. So what are the next steps for Dr. Watson after medical school? What do we see as next steps? Well, the next thing that I would like to see would be to have unsupervised or semi-supervised summary and synthesis of the electronic medical record. This would be the equivalent of sort of a chart review, so that the software would be able to evaluate for drug interactions, discrepancies between medications and the patient's diagnoses, screen for recommended guidelines such as a diabetic who's not had a retinal examination in the last 3 years. As a radiologist, I would love the idea of getting more than just the indication for the MRI or PET CT scan I'm about to read, but to be able to have a good summary and synthesis about what's important in the record, and I rarely get that. Number eight, slide 18, please. The next thing, of course, would be medical diagnosis. And for medical diagnosis, there's two types of medical diagnosis that we see. One would be chart review type of diagnosis, where the Watson software would take information from the outpatient chart or the inpatient chart. It might utilize a patient health record, which would have a superset of information from multiple patient, outpatient, and inpatient visits, for example. And then it would recognize and evaluate patient signs and symptoms and make a diagnosis in either a supervised or semi-supervised fashion, interacting with physicians, including, as it already has the capability to do, assessing probability of disease. Next slide, number 19, please. And the next scenario is the emergency department type of scenario where you want it to help out with real-time decision-making. You can't use the same model as with chart review, certainly not the same model as with ICE. With the initial internist one or two, where there was a long interaction. And so what we need are better ways to be able to capture patient information at the point of care. You wait until the physicians in the ER have written the patient's chart and have the Watson software read that, because at that point decisions have already been made. So you need it to, in some live way, be able to monitor vital signs, lab signal information. We need to determine whether there are additional methods of inputting data, such as even capturing live conversations with providers and patients, which is why Nuance has been a partner. Next slide, number 20, interactive dynamic diagnosis. So what we want is the ability of the physician to be able to not only utilize Watson, to not utilize Watson as a separate entity, but I want to emphasize that the discussions we've had is Watson as an assistant. So in many ways, the best analogy I can think of is that I work with residents and fellows on a regular basis. Sure, sometimes they make silly mistakes, the same way that the Jeopardy software made a couple silly mistakes on its way to winning the three-day quiz show. But I want to have the capability of being able to act with the system, interact with the system as I would with a resident and fellow, have it suggest possibilities, summarize and synthesize information for me. Next slide, 21. The other challenge, I think, that's another grand challenge, is the potential to ingest databases. Since all the announcement was made, about Dr. Watson and some of the work we're doing with IBM, I've been contacted by a number of different folks who have really interesting databases, a Parkinson's database at Johns Hopkins, a leukemia database at MD Anderson, and many others that have databases but no easy mechanisms for researchers or clinicians to be able to discover and consume those. There's no set of ontologies or categories or classifications for how to discover the databases and how to learn inherently what's in the databases, so a system, expert system such as Watson, would be able to use these incredibly valuable, potentially, databases in its decision-making. And for slide 22, I've already really addressed the emergency department scenario, so I won't go over that. In slide number 23, we talk a little bit about the potential for treatment options. And, you know, as a physician, I really cannot keep up with all of the latest literature on either diagnosis or certainly the rapidly changing literature on treatment. And so the potential for the system to be able to not only be up to date on treatment options, but to be able to truly personalize medical treatment to a specific patient. What's the right therapy for a patient with this disease? Or what about if the patient is pregnant? What about if the patient has this other drug that the patient is on? How do you make decisions? And so if you go to slide 24, there's been a tremendous amount of discussion and speculation, even a discussion about teaching Dr. Watson, quote-unquote, bedside manners. You know, according to a study done by Mayo Clinic in 2006, the characteristics that patients are looking for in a good doctor and maybe good assistant in Dr. Watson are confidence, empathy, the fact that they want their provider to be humane, personal, forthright, respectful, and thorough. And, you know, how can we impute those, or how can we give those qualities to software like a Dr. Watson? How do we embody Dr. Watson, even as an which is really what we're talking about and designing it to do. So the last slide, 25, is the conclusion slide. And it's really important to emphasize that there are major fundamental differences between the challenge to the Jeopardy quiz team and medical applications. And those include the fact that information may be incorrect or ambiguous in medicine, which is not true in the Jeopardy quiz show. You may have more than one correct diagnosis in medicine, which also wasn't true in Jeopardy. So you need to take into strong consideration diseases that are really serious and could cause serious harm. So even if there's a small chance that my patient in the emergency room, based on their signs and symptoms, has a myocardial infarction, because the consequences are so serious, I may end up weighting that diagnosis in a way that's different from other possibilities. The Watson QA technology and Jeopardy demonstration, I think, have captured the imagination of many people, including many of us in healthcare. And I think it could provide a critical springboard. And so even if the techniques that were used to be so incredibly effective on Jeopardy to do the quiz questions are not utilized for the Dr. Watson medical application, I think the way it's captured our imaginations and the way they've demonstrated that it can learn on its own and ingest information without having it essentially hard-coded like MySim and Internist 1 and 2 were, are really, really important. And I think the potential of these to revolutionize medicine is really tremendous and exciting. So thanks so much for the opportunity to sort of present some of these grand challenges. I think there are many in my presentation, and I'd be really delighted to, you know, engage with your group and community in the future as we move forward. So thanks very much.
Thank you very much, Elliot. I know that you have to run right now, so we will hold off any questions for offline.
Okay.
So I presume they have your email address and they can correspond with you.
They can, and many
okay,
have.
Okay.
So. Absolutely. Great. Thank you so much.
Thank you again. We'll have to go on right now in the interest of time. We have three more speakers, and again, I would like the speakers to restrict for 15 minutes and maybe 5 minutes question-answer session as such, okay? Our next speaker is Chris Jude from Mayo Clinic. Chris, ready?
Sure, let's go. So let's skip right to the second slide. This is obviously about ICD-11 and its relationship to ontologies. And the second slide, it's simply pointing out that if you think of the patient on that far left as the patient encounter as the center or the beginning of everything, then we use that data to improve care, generate knowledge, and that knowledge in turn improves care. What holds that together, of course, are shared semantics, be it in the context of standards or otherwise, and that's sort of our view of where ontologies fit into the clinical spectrum. On slide 3, it raises the question of, well, gosh, if we're going to talk about describing patients and generating knowledge and improving care, how do we characterize disease? How do we actually characterize what's wrong with people, and how do we classify these kinds of things? And the word phenotype is often used. We've overloaded it in this context to really mean a clinical phenotype, that is a disease manifestation. But even that gets a little squirrely. I mean, if we look at it from the perspective of a pharmacologist or a pharmacogenomicist, they're going to study enzymes and call an enzyme a phenotype, which to a clinician is really bizarre. Similarly, a physiologist is going to focus at the cellular level. And you see the spectrum there right up to public health, where you're dealing with whole populations. So the question of where is the disease and what is its context and how is this factored becomes complex as we think about classification. So on slide 4, One of the goals of the ICD-11, and the ICD, for those of you that don't know, is the International Classification of Disease. It has roughly 150-year history, presently managed by the World Health Organization, and it's in the midst of its first major revision for the past 30 years. I think the punchline is that this is not your father's ICD. We're focusing, as you can see, on its use cases, among other things, on a scientific consensus of clinical phenotype. That is, scientifically, how do we characterize disease? And this is really the nub of the challenge, if you think about it that way. On slide 5, it's an incredibly boring slide, which is a sort of a stick hierarchy, and that sort of represents the traditional structure of ICD, which is fixed-length hierarchy with not much information on each node, essentially a character string and a code, and that's about all she wrote. If we look at slide 6, we're starting to say, well, okay, can we fatten up those nodes a little bit? Add some metadata, if you will, about a concept, ontological characteristics, if you want to presume to use that term, but at least information about what we're talking about, definitions, is language, preferred strings, synonyms, and the like. On slide 7, you're looking at the model of ICD-11 as it stands today. It actually has a UML rendition, but this is sort of the one PowerPoint slide view of this, and as you can see, each node in ICD-11 has the potential for significant metadata and information, including etiologic characteristics, causal characteristics, genomic information, and the like, in ways that historically ICD never had. Now we're starting to think about, well, what is the ontological linkage, and it begs how these models would be populated. Are we going to use free text? Well, heck, I hope not, at least not forever. Are we going to populate genomic risk factors and the like with well-structured, ontologically based information? And that's really the crux of the question. If you look at the next slide, on 8, it's somewhat whimsical because we're not really defining ICD-11 this way, but it puts it in quasi-ontological framing, if you will, with some assertions about lung cancer that arguably may be true, may be partially true. And if you're particularly looking at symptomatology, the sad reality is that those are really probabilistic observations, and I'm going to return to that because description logics don't deal very well, last I checked, with probabilistic assertions, and it's or sometimes true assertions, if you want to put them in that context. The next slide, 9, says, well, okay, we have a strict hierarchy in ICD historically, and that's done for a reason, not because we're stupid, but because a strict hierarchy has the advantage of not counting things twice. We actually have a fancy word for it, mutually exclusive. And if you're doing public health stuff like mortality or morbidity statistics, you really don't want to count events twice. On the other hand, a gastric cancer really is a GI disease at the same time that it's a cancer. So you do have the semantic arcing, if you want to think of it that way, between and among branches on the hierarchy, and we've sort of represented that in color whimsically on slide 9. Slide 10 says, if we really do have to have this mutually exclusive serialization, if you want to think of it that way, then why don't we go ahead and make an acyclic graph, you know, a quasi-ontological representation of an inflection space like that cloud to the left with the colored arcs between and among. But we will be able to serialize that and make an explicit choice, if you will, of preferred parents. Think of them as the black parents on this particular slide, the dark lines, rather than we just ignore all the colored lines when we make a serialization of what is essentially an acyclic graph representation. And that starts to suggest that we have an interesting structure. So on slide 11, we're saying, okay, we have this concept of an ICD-11 entity, which is an object. Think of it as an object. They can have terms, definitions, comments, structure, information, and that they in turn should be drawn from reference ontologies, and we'll talk about SNOMED in a minute and some other potential ontologies for ICD-11. But that category layer is really that cloud layer. That's the acyclic graph core, and that's really the heart of ICD-11 as it's evolving, from which we can make an arbitrary number of linearizations or serializations. And that's on slide 12, we can see again, if you actually blow up the slide, you'll see it's all the same darn graph, but we'll ignore that. You could make a mortality rendition. You could make a morbidity rendition. You could make a quality rendition, a reimbursement rendition, public health rendition. There's no limit to how many serializations you can make of varying depth and varying precision and varying completeness. They are all linked, however, in that they are semantic derivatives from that core cloud information space, which is, it gives them linkage. On slide 13, you see the current authoring tool, and it bears a striking resemblance to the information model if you look at the tabs on the right side. This, of course, is Protégé under the hood. This has been developed by the Stanford group with Mark Musin and Tanya, I can never get her right last name, but Natasha's online. She can tell you what Tanya's last name is. Giving us a framework or, if you will, a 21st century environment for entering and managing the underlying content of an artifact that's becoming as complex as ICD-11. If we look at slide 14, this just shows the structural organization of how we're doing this, and of relevance is the health information modeling tag on the left side, a full-fledged tag. I actually chair the revision steering group in blue. That's kind of one of my jobs. On slide 15, we raise the question of crowdsourcing and wikis. I won't expend a lot of time on that other than to say to populate this full model, we're going to have structured proposals drawn from the larger scientific public, if you want to think of it that way, where the topic advisory groups or tags would operate as an editorial board. On slide 16, I'm raising the relationship we'd have with the International Health Terminology Standards Development Organization, fondly known as ITSIDU, the bringers of SNOMED, among other things. And the short version is we now have a memorandum of agreement where we've agreed to populate the content model with SNOMED elements as an ontological framing, if you will, of the slots for ICD-11 classifications and categories. And similarly, ICD will contribute to as you see in slide 17. Now, these are animated. Trust me, I spent hours making these animated slides. Sadly, they don't work too well in PDF. But the framework here is that, you know, SNOMED and ICD were kind of doing the same thing. And in the green space, if we weren't careful, SNOMED would reinvent what we were doing. And as we extend ICD, if we weren't careful, we would reinvent what they were doing. And the slide 18, if it were animated, would show that we all magically come together and that the green layer is essentially ICD within SNOMED, or the aggregation layer, or high-level ontology, if you want to think of it that way, for detailed clinical terminologies within SNOMED, with serializations that derive from it. Slide 19 starts to raise some interesting questions about, well, if we're going to go there, then how do we actually characterize disease? Phenomenological is arguably not an ontological definition because it's symptoms and syndromes and characteristics that, frankly, clinicians use to recognize disease, which is very, very non-ontological. Logical assertions, so a pathophysiologic fact, okay, ontologies and SNOMED can deal with that very beautifully, but it's not really clinically relevant. And then there's some other alternatives there, etiologic, anatomical, descriptive, clinomic, that we could go on there. Slide 20 shows a classification structure, the always popular random list, which is largely what ICD had been in its early years, became a structured hierarchy, kind of introducing a frame logic structure, if you want to think of it that way. We are not yet at a framework where I would characterize ICD-11 as a description logic. And I'll skip slide 21. You know about that. Other than the bottom statement, which says logic assertions cannot handle probability. And if we look at slide 22, this is what SNOMED has to say about myocardial infarction. The myocardial disease, the injury of an anatomical site that's a structural disorder of the heart. Thanks, guys. That's not what a clinician wants to know. It happens to be true. It happens to be ontologically accurate. But it's clinically useless and meaningless. I mean, I don't want to know that a myocardial infarction is the death of myocytes. I want to know something like slide 23, which are, how do I diagnose an MI? And this is sort of a rule algorithm that my chairman and my present department uses to define myocardial infarction in her study, where you're bringing together chest pain concepts, diagnostic EKG findings, biomarkers that are serum markers to establish whether or not a particular patient, and it runs along a spectrum of absolutely no MI to an absolutely definite MI and some sort of gray spaces in between. And description logics, last I checked, don't do this very well. So in slide 24, just to point out that the whole problem of phenotyping algorithms, phenotyping rules, has been really this topic of the NHGRI work and the eMERGE consortium. Slide 25 says we're continuing some of that in the Office of the National Coordinator-funded SHARP consortium, where you see high-throughput phenotyping is really one of our core tasks amidst others of data normalization, NLP, and the like. And there's UEMA down there for you Watson fans. That's also from IBM. That's relevant. Just a reminder on slide 26, the clinical phenotype is part of our ICD-11 use case. And my summary slides on 27 is ICD is embracing a rich information model for the first time ever. Historically, it's been a very bland, shallow, if somewhat pointless information model. We're trying to explicitly link our frame structures to structured ontologies. We're focusing mostly on phenomenological descriptions of phenotype because that's what clinicians see and understand. And the question is, well, can you sprinkle it with ontological elements and formalize it to some extent? It raises questions about what is an aggregation logic then? How do we actually group observations into a summary classification diagnosis? To what extent can description logics really help us? And how do we manage the challenge of the reality of probabilistic information? Because there is no disease classification discrete definition where all elements or aspects of it are always true. That's just not the way people work. So I think that's 15 minutes.
Thank you very much, Chris. And we have, and how do you kind of see all this tie into the Watson thing? I believe that you made a comment on that in terms of the grand challenge.
Well, I mean, Watson, of course, is built on the unstructured information management architecture, UEMA. And when we're doing, which we have been using it as an alpha user since 2003, mostly for our NLP, but we're bringing it to the phenotyping challenges as well as clinical data normalization and the like. To what extent can we leverage tools and information resources like that from the Watson perspective of using similar tooling and framework, but from the broader scope, grand challenge perspective, I think it's really we leverage description logics in a circumstance where the reality is that we're dealing with probabilistic or phenomenological characterization.
Uh-huh. Okay, because we need to kind of carry on right now, then we'll go to our next speaker. Was going to be Nabil Adam. Nabil, are you ready?
Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you very much for giving me the opportunity to share with you very briefly preliminary ideas about ontology in the context of homeland security. So it's a bit different than what we heard earlier, but if we start with the first slide, number one, where I say why ontology, we didn't know that one way to think of ontology is a way to capture the semantics of a given domain or a set of domains, and think of that semantics in terms of concepts and how do we describe those concepts in terms of the attributes, and also how those concepts relate to each other. And I think several examples have been illustrated throughout the session today. So why do we need to use ontology? There are many reasons. We have seen from the previous talks several of those, but in the context of homeland security, I can think of two main reasons or applications or use of ontology. One is that we want to resolve the semantic differences when we are trying to get information from various sources and trying to bring together information that comes from different underlying domains. And why do we want to do that? We want to do that for several purposes. Among those is information sharing and data integration. And in our context of Homeland Security, that becomes important. That's not to say others in other areas also is not. And I'll elaborate a bit more later on. Another is pointed out before is I want to also to do some reasoning on the on certain information and try based on the in that ontology and knowledge and information that emphasis is to recommend certain action or recommend certain models and so on. So that reasoning making inferences is another use or example of application of ontology. So here we have to think in terms of we want to support automated inferences. So one possible way is to use or apply description logics, and I think the previous speaker did talk about that and some of the limitations, obviously, and some of the performance issues that that one has to be concerned about, especially if we are considering real-time applications. As far as DHS, and I just wanted to make a footnote here that actually DHS is a big department, as we all know, and it is a complex one, as I very well know, being here for 2 years or so. And there is a DHS has several components, but one directorate called Science and Technology Directorate, which is responsible for basically the research and development arm. It's the research, it serves as the research and development arm of DHS. So we get requests for gaps of that the components see needs to be fulfilled, and we try to develop programs, research and develop programs to satisfy those gaps, and try to do that in with the time frame in mind. So we think the stress very much here. Okay, you can have basic research, or you can have applied research. Applied research, you have to think in terms of 2 years, 3 years, where the results have to be transferred or transitioned to a product that one of the components, actual customer, would actually be using it. And there was a lot of emphasis on the latter one. I work on in that context, and I'm going to go back to that question in a year or two. So DHS is actually start thinking about ontology, interestingly enough. And a first attempt was made to think in terms of infrastructure, the taxonomy, not ontology, and we all know the difference, but they thought in terms of taxonomy. Let's start first with taxonomy. And again, you know, where do you put the boundaries? So they started with thinking in terms of infrastructure of taxonomy. So let's limit the taxonomy to a specific area, which is infrastructure. And they developed actually several versions of that taxonomy. The latest one is version 4, and that is actually available publicly. And basically the rationale is saying, look, we need to protect the nation's critical infrastructure and key resources. And in case you do not know, all of them, there are 18 critical infrastructures in the country, scale and public health, energy, water, dams, and so on. But you can get the list from the public side. So therefore, there is a need to communicate with the infrastructure owners and operators. And a footnote here is that over 85% of the critical infrastructure of the nation is privately owned and operated. So the government cannot just go and dictate anything there. So so there has to be partnership, there has to be communication. There's information that DHS puts together, models, and has to be disseminated. So you need to be able to have some agility and some basic the structure for that kind of communication to be effective. So that's the rationale of trying to get the taxonomy together. And they have put together an elaborate structure, and I do not need to go in the details of that, but as I mentioned, the latest version is online and the working. So this is one attempt, and there was a recent attempt to actually think in terms of developing ontology, and I will come to that later on at the end. But there's not much activities yet going on, and I'm thinking in terms of the Watson in the area of homeland security. I thought I'd give an example or two examples of specifically where ontology is being used, some of the challenges in using it from my point of view. One example where ontology have been used is one of the programs that they have is modeling, simulation, and analysis in the area of infrastructure protection. And what I'm trying to do is we develop a system that we call SEMSET, that complex event modeling, simulation, analysis. That program, actually, we have two performers, Lockheed Martin and Boeing. They started a year ago, and we have a working prototype. So I made sure that we try to make use of some of the ontologies, especially the ones that are out there and a number of examples of those. And the idea is to try to enable analysts, when they get a question, to be able to dynamically compose appropriate models together, string them together in a more complex model. So in order to answer the question of what's the impact of the and the hurricane and the nuclear dispersion on civil infrastructure, on water, on dams, on X, Y, and Z, there you may need to get specialized models, models for plume dispersion, models for nuclear action, models for flood, and so on. And you put them together to satisfy that specific question. So instead of starting from scratch, we then go and get these component models, put them together to satisfy that question. So we're trying to achieve that dynamic model composability and interoperability with an underlying semantics. The semantics is derived from the ontology as well as also DHS taxonomy. So that's an example, and I will show you in the next slide a quick view of that. Then the UICDS, which is Unified Incident Command Decision Support, which also I'm involved in, is basically trying to have an emergency management situation where there is a need for information sharing and resource sharing and possibly also supply chain. There is a need to have the different systems talk to each other and understand the terms of each other. Interesting enough, I think in New York and New Jersey, they refer to an ambulance differently. So that was interesting. So if you go to the next slide, slide number four, talks about complex event modeling submission analysis. That program basically says, here we have SEMSA, which is the complex event modeling submission analysis. What we would like to do is expose, enable the analyst at different parts of DHS, and I'm using some, really that's not appropriate, some acronyms for that come from DHS, but we all know FEMA, what FEMA stands for. RMA is Risk Management Analysis Component. HITRAC is Homeland Infrastructure threat and risk analysis centers. So different parts of DHS that would then be able to, through that sensor, be able to gain access to the different models that already exist that we had have invested in. Those models are residing at the NESAC. NESAC is the National Infrastructure Simulation and Analysis Center, and that is a collection of two of the national labs, Sandia and Los Alamos. And they basically help us to develop those models. We have X number of models, about 50 or so. And then we have different databases on the right-hand side. So just within DHS Enterprise, you can see that we would like to automate the process of analysts sitting, giving a question, and the sensor then would go interrogate what are the available applicable models that then can be strung together, composed to answer that question. But usually there is a strict timeline. Could be 4 hours, 2 hours, 12 hours. So it could be that the secretary needs to know what the impact, or the White House wants to know the impact or the consequences of such and such on civil infrastructure. The customer that we serve, the HITRAC, is actually mandated by Congress to manage the model simulation and analysis for the infrastructure of the country. And they receive the requests and questions from leadership at DHS and the White House, and leadership from other agencies also. And obviously FEMA, we know what they do. So time is of essence here, and accuracy is of essence here. So a number of things also in terms of don't just give the answer, but enable the analyst to actually trace the different models, understand, and be able to get credibility, gain credibility, and gain confidence in the results, and not just here's the answer. So that's a very important part. So SIMSA tries to accomplish that, relying on semantics coming from the ontology. But then we thought we should also reach out to the outside world, like DoD, university, industry partners, instead of us trying to duplicate some of the models that might be out there. Maybe through our sensor, we'd be able then to gain access to those models. Again, that raises the interesting question of ontology and making sure that that communication is on a solid basis. So this is one program that I'm using, and we are using ontology there. It's only 1 year, so. There's a lot of work to be done. Another program is, and I want to make sure that they're sensitive to the time here, is the UICDS, where, again, we are talking about information sharing within the context of emergency management. So basically where the incident is, the type of incident, the time, then there is appropriate, there is a specific risk rules in a way, not as straightforward. There's some also probabilistic issues there as to which agency would be involved and what resources would be have to be brought to bear and what to do first and what to do next. So here we also are using ontology in order to try to address the difference in the terminology and interoperability of the information system. So now what are some of the challenges? Some of the challenges that we are facing now is the ontology development. There are some out there that we can get our hands on, but there are others that are not. And for that to be done, it's human intensive. Where do we get those domain experts? Are not easy to find and have them dedicated and devote the time. And I think that every one of us in this area would relate to that easily. Second is very important in our context. We present the results and we say, okay, the system and based on the semantics, based on ontology, recommended model A and B and C. The analyst has a bit of difficulties. You need to he or she needs to really be convinced and get credibility. How do you convince them? You walk them through the ontology is obviously not a very constructive way because then they get overwhelmed. So there is a would be interesting to see how can we address that credibility and gaining the confidence from the end user. Obviously, integration and update, that's always the case. And one of the interesting challenges here, Watson, there's a lot of discussion about using it in Habitat and Homeland Security. And again, there are serious decisions that have to be made. So we really cannot, this is not a simple exercise or theoretical exercise. There are major decisions that need to be made at different levels of the government up to the White House. So, there is a lot of care and attention that have to be paid to make sure that the partnership serves as a basis for the recommendation for the decision maker is correct and valid and so on.
Nabil, if I may interrupt you for a minute here, I think we need to carry on in the interest of time.
I'm done, actually.
So, essentially, I think what you're trying to say is that there are two challenges here. One is the grand challenge problem, which is in the Homeland Security. Did I get the simulation thing that you put forward as one of the problems?
Right.
And the other one is that how do you solve this thing by using ontologies, and here are the challenges associated with that.
Right.
And that's your last slide, I guess.
Yeah.
So what my suggestion right now is maybe we should carry on here, and because as I said, in the interest of time.
Yeah.
Chris, are you online? Chris, can you hear us?
Yes.
Yeah. Can you go ahead? And we have about maybe a total of 15 minutes for everything here. I'm sorry that we ran over a couple of presentations in terms of time. So.
Okay.
So you have about 15 minutes or so here.
Okay, I'll try to get through it pretty quickly.
Okay, thank you.
So I've been hearing a lot of interesting things today, and what the presentation I'm going to give is completely different than everything else you've been hearing. And
that's supposed to be. That's why we have you in the back.
What we want to talk about is how can we use prizes to solve some of these grand challenges. So I'm just going to give you a quick overview of who we are at the XPRIZE. And then essentially give you reference material in case you want to design a prize that is relevant to the grant challenges that you're all speaking of. So going to the presentation, if you go to the second slide, we really began with the SpaceX Prize, the Ansari X Prize, $10 million prize for the first privately financed team to fly a spaceship. 26 teams from 7 nations spent over $100 million. If you go to the next slide, what was interesting about the prize is that we started out with $2.5 million in seed money from the St. Louis Science Center, developed a $10 million prize sponsored by Ansari. Over $100 million was spent in the pursuit. Now, the team that won actually spent $27 million to win 10. It created a $1 billion private space industry. So, very basic level, it's highly leveraged, it was efficient, and it sparked a new industry. And the whole idea here is that small amounts of investment capital can be highly leveraged to create a new industry. If you go to the next slide, but it's not about space, and it never was. That was just a way for us to show that you can transform the way we can solve humanity's greatest challenges. So, next slide, where we are now with the XPRIZE Foundation, as we have 4 prize groups, Life Sciences, Eileen's actually in charge of that one, Exploration, so Life Sciences is health, Exploration is deep space, deep ocean, Energy and Environment, I head up that group, that's anything to do with energy and the environment, and then Education and Global Development, and that's self-explanatory too, things like fireless, smokeless cook stoves, things like that. If you go to the next slide, just some of the things that we're doing now. We just had a $10 million Progressive X Prize, Automotive X Prize, first car that can get 100 miles per gallon equivalent. Next slide, we have a genomics one.
sequence 100 human genomes in 10 days or less, essentially this will make it so that any individual could go into a doctor's office, there'd be a process, they'd be able to figure out where the problems are based on their genes. Next slide. We also have a Google Lunar X Prize right now. This is a $30 million one for the first privately funded company to put a lunar on the moon. And you'll keep hearing these things, privately funded. And this is to get away from the paradigm where people think that space is only accessible by the government. And in every prize we do, we try to have a paradigm shift. With space, it's usually just away from the government. The next slide, we also have a $1.5 million, so $1.4 here, so that's the most that goes to the big company or the team that wins, but there's another $100,000 in prizes dealing with oil spills. Next slide. Now, why would you look at prizes to solve your grand challenge? Next slide. There's been a surge in prize capital since 1970. If you look at this chart on the left, and you're looking at prizes that have purses over $100,000, in 2010, there was $350 million in prize purses. The growth of the use of prizes is growing. On the right side, you can see some of the things that are out there, and they range from things like the NASA Centennial Challenge, which they do these prizes to do things like, for example, astronaut gloves that have more dexterity. And there's lots of organizations out there that are doing prizes. Next slide. The reason that this growth has happened is because of new sponsors and fields. So before 1991, 97% of big prizes were what we call recognition prizes. These are like the Nobel Prizes. Somebody did something, they weren't trying to achieve a specific goal, they just did something that had a large impact on human race, and they get an award for it. Since 1991, 78% of the new prize money has been directed towards inducement prizes. So unlike a recognition prize, this is one where you put a goal out there, and the first team that achieves that goal will get the money. So instead of doing research for research sake to come up with great ideas, which is very important, you're saying, okay, we have this specific problem, let's attack that specific problem, and somebody will win an award. You can also look at, there's more money coming in from private foundations and corporations. And also, prizes are shifting from traditional areas such as the arts, which used to be about 10 years ago was one-third of all these prizes, and now it's less than 10% of the total. So people are realizing these work for things dealing with the environment, dealing with space, dealing with education. Next slide, we'll just glance at this one very quickly. Prizes have distinctive attributes that are reinforced by broader social trends to encourage use and experimentation. So people are using these. The social trends are we have some new wealth, philanthropists that aren't doing what their family foundations or they're starting new foundations, they're doing things totally different. People are frustrated with current approaches to attacking grand challenges. We have the internet where you can get large amounts of people together, like we're doing today, to solve problems. Same thing, the internet helps with lots of people out there, technology out there, at a low cost, you could throw a ton of technology at something to solve the problem. And we have a society that's really into multimedia and likes to see exciting things. Prizes allow donors to be expressive. They can do something that hasn't been done before. Allow them to be flexible. They can try new approaches with very little cost, to be completely honest. If you take, for example, a company that wants to develop a new technology, they might spend hundreds of millions of dollars to focus on one technology. What if they could give $10 million to have 50 teams spend $10 to $12 million each to solve the same type of outcome? Then you have all these opportunities to choose from different technologies. Now, they might not own those technologies, but then they could quickly invest in them. And you're not awarding anything until it's success. So if you flip to the next slide, this is where we sort of get into the meat of it. prizes deliver change in essentially 7 ways. They identify and mobilize new talent. When you have a prize, you always have people that aren't necessarily accepted in the field, in addition to academics, companies, and those kind of things. So you have guys that have an idea written on the back of a napkin. They help identify excellence, right? Because you're going out there and you're looking for people. They focus the community. Everybody's focused on the same idea, not the same technical solution. They're focused on the same outcome. It can influence public perception. You could do a lot of things that will get the public on board from a meeting and marketing standpoint. So they strengthen communities. The way prizes are designed, you have a ton of collaboration. You have all these meetings. You have teams doing side challenges where you take people from the main teams and you make new teams and they learn from each other. You can get that guy with the idea on the back of the napkin in touch with the big company. And they mobilize capital. Capital often follows prizes. So if there's a prize announced, it legitimizes the process and the solution that you're looking for, and therefore oftentimes venture capital money, private equity money follows behind. If you turn to the next slide, there are some disadvantages of prizes. So if your brand's challenges deal with situations such as zero-sum games, you're not going to want to use a prize. They don't really offer incentives for incremental improvement. They really offer opportunities for leapfrogs in technology or leapfrogs in thinking. They can be expensive by teams. Investments by teams can be extremely expensive. So the prize has to be designed in a manner that makes it worthwhile for the teams to compete. They don't really tout the second place and third place winners. So somebody can get really close and they won't win. And so you can get around this by marketing and get around this by introducing those second and third place winners to VCs and private equity firms and other companies, but people usually focus on the winner. And prizes often fail to attract people that don't see the market opportunity. So that's the research for research sake. They usually only attract people that think they're going to make a lot of money in a market that's developed by the product. So, switching to the next slide, this is where we'll talk about how do you design a prize. And these are kind of what the reference materials will be for you going down the line. Next slide. There's 5 real steps. Goal setting. What do you want to achieve? What's the strategy? You know, how long is the prize going to take? How much are you going to the prize going to be worth? What do all the stakeholders need? What do the competitors need? You know, we're designing a prize right now that has to deal with capturing carbon dioxide from power plants and converting it into usable products. Well, the competitors, they want to show the smallest demonstration possible. The utilities who want to adopt this want to see the biggest demonstration scale possible because they want to be secure in it. The competitors don't want to spend a lot of money. The utilities want it to be at a point where it's proven to them. So how do you manage that? Prize design elements and prize operations and marketing, these are, you know, how do you bring that prize forward? What are the operational needs? How much is it going to cost? How are you going to keep the public interested? The space home is very easy. You know, people could stand there and see a plane go into space and see it land again. That's really exciting. That's telegenic. But a lot of prizes don't have that. So how do you get to the same goal? And then you want to make sure there is a legacy following the prize. You want to make sure it creates an industry. You want to make sure the prize is run. You want to make sure that new companies continue to enter that marketplace because the prize created that marketplace. So if you switch to the next prize, there's a bunch of different prize models. Go through this very briefly. You have your participation prizes, which inspire people to change behaviors. You have your exemplar prizes, which define excellence within an arena. You have your network prizes that empower and invest in the broader stakeholder ecosystem. So, excuse me, these are just forums for interaction, sort of like what we're doing here. You have your exposition prizes. Those are ones that just highlight a lot of really good ideas, sort of like the World Fair. Point solution prizes and market simulation is the last two. These are the ones that we have found work best for incentive prize and competition. And these are the ones where you're really trying to change the market. Next slide. We find that there's a bunch of different prize structures, and I'm not going to go into this. I just want you to have this in the back of your mind if you do design design the prize, because this is an important step. Next slide. Now, there's a bunch of myths about design. People think there's only two types of prizes, recognition prizes and incentive prizes. But they can have many different formats. People think that you have to have really big purses for people to want to compete. That's not true. You'll often find that competitors spend more than the prize purse. People think it's all about the competition. That's not true either. A lot of times, competitors compete because they know they'll be able to collaborate with the other teams and learn from the other teams. Because when you think about it, you're creating a new industry, and they might not know each other, or they might be dispersed, and this is a way to bring them together. It's all about the winner. Well, we try not to make it all about the winner. We want to be about the prize competition itself and the, every competitor. And prizes are easy. This is probably the biggest myth. Good prizes take a long time to develop. And it's a multi-step process. The next slide, and I apologize for going super fast. These slides are going to teach you how to design a prize. So, what market failure are you trying to address? What's the metric? The best prizes have clear metrics so that it seems fair to everybody and everybody knows who wins. Again, looking at the space one, you saw it happen. Now, if you deal with ones where you have to do life cycle analysis of products, that gets a little bit more complicated. Is it audacious? Is it really going to make that big of a change, but at the same time, is it achievable within 5 to 8 years? You can have an amazing prize that's not achievable, and it's not achievable, and nobody will compete. Next slide. When you craft a prize, you just have to come up with some general thing. What's the name? You want a captivating name. What's the one sentence descriptor? This is your elevator pitch. How much are you going to give? You want to give enough to get people to compete. What are the guidelines? Those are the rules. And what's the paradigm you want to see happen? Next slide. You have to fine-tune what you came up with. You want to make sure you're defining a problem and not a solution. You don't want to tell people how to do it. You just want to tell people what you want done. Is there a business model at the end for the competitors? Is there a market for them? Telegenic finish. Is it exciting? Can we get the media impression? The thing with Ansari and most of our other prizes is the media impressions are in the billions. And what's the operations cost? Is it going to be too much to run? Now, for the final slide, if you look at that prize design process, which I just flew through and I apologize, this is what it would look like if we put the Ansari X Prize that introduced at the beginning into it. Prize name, the X Prize for private space flight. Market failure, no money being invested in private human space flight. One-line descriptor, a $10 million competition for the first team to build a privately funded spaceship with these goals. Prize amount, $10 million. Guidelines, headline, space flight for all, now reality. So you can see how those previous slides, if you answer all those questions, you can design a prize. And we'd be very happy to talk with any of you and help any of you through the process if you find that prizes are relevant to the grand challenges that you are addressing today. So final slide. If anybody has any questions, I know we're out of time, and I apologize for flying through. But
no problem. I think it was pretty informative. And thank you very much, Chris.
No,
I guess, Peter, we don't have much time now. Ernie, if you have any closing comments? Is Ernie there?
Yeah. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay, now I don't have any closing comments. I think it went very well.
Yeah. And I will basically have to summarize these things soon. But anyway, I think it's around 2:32 or so now. So Peter, what's the protocol now? Is Peter on?
Yes. If there's no other question, then we will look forward to everyone joining us next week when we are going to have an all-hands synthesis and reporting session from all the tracks and the communique lead editing team. So next Thursday.
Okay. Pleasure for everyone. And thank you again for the panelists for the very informative presentations.
Thank you, guys.
Bye.
Well, thank you. Bye-bye.